Hey, it's Jody Stevens with Those Pretty Wrongs and formerly a big star, and you're listening to The Vinyl Guide.
This episode is brought to you by Groove Washer, the best record cleaners and protective sleeves for your vinyl collection. Ask for the Groove Washer from your local shop or go to groovewasher.com. Discount code VinylGuide10. And now, on with the show.
Well, hey, everyone, it's Nate. Welcome to episode 405 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And this week, we have absolute rock royalty here on the show. Mr. Jody Stevens joins us to talk about his time and the vinyl records of Big Star, as well as his current band, Those Pretty Wrongs. Now, I got to tell you, Those Pretty Wrongs are touring the East Coast of Australia this August, Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, and more, playing the music of Those Pretty Wrongs and selected classic Big Star material. Tickets for Those Pretty Wrongs are available at lovepolice.com.au. Now today, Jody shares all about the Big Star days, the recording of number one record, memories of the band, the early vinyl pressings, the rare records. Jody talks about Chris Bell destroying the master tapes of number one record, discussions of a Big Star reunion prior to Chris's death, and much more. Plus, discussions of the upcoming Australia tour of Those Pretty Wrongs. And, as always, there is a commercial-free and high-resolution version of this interview available only to show patrons at patreon.com/vinylguide. Help us support the show. If you're not a show patron right now, please consider helping us support. $5 or $10 a month, whatever you can afford, is much appreciated. It keeps me stocked with burritos and beer and pumping out these episodes. That's patreon.com/vinylguide. Help support the show and enjoy all the extras. And finally, if you enjoy music history and vinyl records, there are over 400 other episodes of The Vinyl Guide available anytime to enjoy, including interviews with the likes of Billy Bob Thornton and J.D. Andrew of the Boxmasters, episode 403. Comedian, actor, and podcast pioneer Mark Maron joined us, episode 400. Gerald V. Casale sharing all things Devo, episode 366. The amazing bearded bassman Leland Sklar, episode 362. Everyone's favorite stoner Tommy Chong joined us to talk records, episode 320. Robbie Krieger of the Doors, episode 306. Peter Frampton, episode 300, and lots more. Follow the Vinyl Guide podcast in your podcast app of choice for free. Scroll, download, listen, and enjoy. All right, well, let's get into it. Here is the Vinyl Guide interview with Mr. Jody Stevens of Big Star and Those Pretty Wrongs.
Good morning to you.
Mr. Jody Stevens, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
You sound like you shot out of a cannon. You just had a coffee or something?
No, actually, I just had dinner.
Oh, well, look, thank you for taking time out of your evening to join us here on The Vinyl Guide. We are a bunch of record nerds here around the world. Well, let me ask you this. First off, do you have a vinyl record collection? Do you a fan of or a collector of vinyl records?
I'm not. Okay. Even back in the day, I wasn't much with a stylus.
Okay.
I never really touch or could get proper weight, or maybe I just had a cheap, you know, record player, but it's kind of embarrassing to admit, but.
Oh, that's all right. Look, we can't all be nerds to that level.
I love holding vinyl and the whole visual and tactile kind of experience of it.
Yeah, CDs are convenient, and so is streaming. But it's good to know Those Pretty Wrongs, Holiday Camp, is available on vinyl. Zed for Zulu,
yeah.
There are vinyl copies available. So, and people who want to take a look at those and listen in and perhaps even order, those albums are on streaming services, or you can go to thosepettywrongs.com. And also, Those Pretty Wrongs are going to be coming to Australia in August of 2023. So there will be links in this episode page of where to get tickets for that to see Jody and Luther here. Now, Jody, I'm really pleased that Those Pretty Wrongs, you continue to record and use Ardent Studios. That is, to me, is just wonderfully fascinating.
Yeah. We're so lucky. Betty Fry makes that available to us and consequently it's very affordable. So we can do these records. We do them in a timely manner. It's not, you know, we don't get in, hang out and watch YouTube videos and stuff. But we get in there and we take care of business, because usually Luther arrives on one date and he has a plane ticket to leave on another date. So we've got to kind of stay focused. But yes, we're lucky. Arden's it's home. It's great things happen there, and they continue to happen. Luther and I are pretty lucky in that regard with Arden.
Yeah, and it's to me, it's rather fascinating. Like over the last, several decades, so many great recording studios have struggled to keep their doors open, or many of them have even shuttered. And the fact that Arden is still going some 50 years later, I mean, it's a miracle and a testimony to the leadership there and the equipment and the environment of which artists can use.
Yeah, it's like 57 years. John starts the clock. John Fry started the clock in 1966. So it's been a while. And we're at our current location on Madison Avenue. We've been there for 51 years. We moved in January of 52 years, January of 71.
Yeah, the brick building. Oh, in fact, you're even wearing an Arden T-shirt. That's nice. Now, that logo, was new to the label and introduced with the Big Star Records. Is that right?
It was. It's a Ron Picard. This is a non-detailed version of Ron Picard's label that he created for Arden Records.
Because Arden had been going as a record label for some time in the late 60s, but there were different logos, different kind of visual elements to it. But when I guess they struck the deal with Stax for the distribution, and Big Star was the first monkey to be shot into space there, that warranted a new logo and label design.
He did. Ron Picard created the neon Big Star, and which I think everybody knows now was inspired by the grocery store.
Yeah.
Across the street from Arden when we were located on National. And then he created these record labels and the single record sleeves. And yeah, talented guy.
Yeah. Now, the cover of the Big Star 1 album with the neon sign, there was actually a neon sign created for that. Any idea whatever happened to that sign?
It's actually in a picture of John. I think it's John Fry, Al Bell, and Deanie Parker. And if you look in the bottom left-hand corner of the picture, that neon star is sitting on the floor in the corner of the room, and the big is kind of is off and just kind of sitting sort of askew up against the neon star itself. That's the last I'd seen of it.
Okay. As a picture out of the 70s?
Yes, picture from the 70s.
Oh, okay. All right.
It would be 374. When did Stax go under? 74, 75?
I think somewhere around there, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Would have been before that, because of Al Bell and Deanie Parker being in the photo.
So that was one, that was a light. Radio City had another light on it. Was that the ceiling of, I think, Fridays, the bar? Or what was that picture that ceiling of?
Well, that was part of Bill Eggleston or William Eggleston's collection. And Alex was thumbing through his catalog of photos and selected that for the cover of Radio City, and then enlisted Bill Eggleston to shoot the back cover too. And in addition to other photos that he'd done of us. And then he, at some point that red ceiling picture, I think the Museum of Modern Art, some famous museum in New York bought it and included it in their collection. And, I think Bill became known as the father of color photography and taught at Harvard, Yale, and he has showings around the world now.
Oh, phenomenal. So, okay. So we've covered two of the Big Star covers. The third, Big Star Third, that had multiple covers. That had, the initial black and white cover, It had the international cover with the flag, a few other ones. What was your stories or recollection behind the multiple covers of Third?
Well, the fact is that none of them are official. We had nothing to do with the covers that were created for Third.
No input or anything like that?
No. And, you know, I kind of like the black and white one of the two of us. I think Alex is at a Mellotron or something. And I'm in this red, well, it's black and white, but it's a red kind of blazery kind of jacket that I got at a used clothing store that I thought was pretty cool at the time. We didn't have any input. And, we finished recording that album in 74. And John had those vinyl copies pressed up because he didn't want to carry a tape around. He wanted to hand the album to someone, and the presentation being what it was. This is what it's going to be. And, of course, people apparently made comments like, do I have to listen to that again? Or, you know, kind of snidey comments. But, you know, it eventually came out in 78 on Aura Records in England, and they created their own cover, and then Passport PVC, and they created their own cover. And then, you know, Rykodisc created its own cover, and Omnivore with theirs. And, you know, they're all fine. I was never asked. You know, they're fine with me. I'd hate to have that responsibility of creating a cover for Third.
Well, your preference is the black and white, so I would take that as the official word for the band.
And those are Michael O'Brien photos. Michael shot some really, really nice photos of us. We were lucky that we had these incredibly talented photographers around. Mm-hmm. Michael to. You know, be a photographer for National Geographic. And God, you know, not too long ago, not too many years ago, he did the cover shot of a Tom Waits record. But those pretty wrongs are lucky. We have Luther. Luther creates our work.
That's right. And you've got some colored vinyl copies. And when you tour Australia, you're going to be bringing some of those. Can we see some of that vinyl on the merch table?
I hope so. That's a job for a Red Eye distributor down there. Antonio Foxley's the rep down there. Nice guy. I'm sure we'll have something there.
Very good. So going back to Third, from what I understand, there were about 250 records pressed. This is 74, 75. Just with the white label, that was to get Big Star onto a record label. Those were for industry folks to get passed around. Is that right?
Yeah, that was. Certainly an easy format for anybody, really, because we all had turntables. And I'm sure John thought through everything. He was a very methodical kind of guy, and he just wanted to make it as easy as possible for them. Mm-hmm. And on the best format possible. So, and that was that.
And from those 250, there was the deal with PVC Records. Did that come as a result of those initial pressings, or did that come as a result of kind of the building legacy of Big Star around that time?
I think that was more about the building audience for Big Star.
Okay. There seems to have been, in the history of Big Star, a lot of very collectible records, a lot of experimentation as well. For example, there was a 7-inch single release of The Ballad of El Gudo. It wasn't officially released, but there were test pressings made, of which only a handful are known to exist. Are you aware of this record?
Apparently not.
Do you remember any conversations about The Ballad of El Gudo being released as a single, and maybe that was revoked?
But it would have been a good idea. The only kind of rarity was there was an EP release in Brazil, in South America, and that was kind of an oddity. But cool, I wish I had one of those.
Me too. That's worth a couple car payments if you could find one. Yeah, so that is absolutely a rarity. There's also a single from an Ardent single of 13, but it's mislabeled as Don't Lie to Me. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, that'd be another collector's thing, wouldn't it?
Yeah. But no recollection of those singles going out with the wrong labels on the record?
There's not. I think I heard that subsequent to the releases. I mean, you know, years later or something.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall the band getting test pressings of Number One Record or Radio City in the early days?
Chris would have done that. It would have gone to Chris and John Fry.
Okay.
I mean, you know, Alex had experience with all that, but it probably Chris and John. And John, there's no more discerning ears than John Fry's.
Because I know in the studio, a lot of care and time was taken to, you know, have just a sonically beautiful album.
Yeah.
Do you recall a similar kind of approach to quality when it came to record pressing and trying different masterings and things like that?
I wouldn't be surprised, really, because John was a sonic perfectionist, and I'm sure he would have demanded that they sound as good as his mixes coming off the tape.
Mm.
You know, maybe you could do something to even improve that. But he and Larry Nix cut the vinyl for those things.
Okay.
John could, as opposed to running a compressor or a limiter for peaks, and John could do that manually because he knew where they might be, having recorded and mixed it. So again, there's not just a uniform chopping off of peaks and stuff. It's something that's more organic, I guess. And consequently, those records sound amazing. And then Encore just did in the last couple of years that Jeff Powell cut the vinyl on, and they sound amazing.
Yeah. Do you recall the inscription of the Number One Record in the Runout Groove, the words that were in the Runout Groove?
I don't. Like, there was a planet or something, wasn't there, on one of them? But I don't remember what was. I know there was something. Just apparently Chris wrote something and then dropped the stylus and ruined it, so they had to go back and recut it.
The inscription of the earliest pressing of Number One Record is on side B, quote, "The more you learn, the less you know."
Oh, right. Yeah.
Any idea where that would have come from?
I would think it came from Chris. Could have come from Andy.
Okay.
That sounds like an Andyism.
The first pressings also had a poster and a few promotional photos in there. Any recollection about the story of those?
Are you talking about like something that went out in a little folder?
They were stuffed inside the record, from what I understand. There was actually the first pressing, I believe, had a poster. There were a couple promotional photos, and then some had a media kit along with it. Those probably would have gone to the reviewers, but I believe the posters, the Big Star posters, went out to the general public.
Wow. Well, I have a copy of Number One Record that probably has been played four or five times, and I, you know, there's that it didn't include that, and I also have a copy that's never been opened.
Oh, okay.
I'm kind of saving to supplement one of our tours or something.
You probably could. That's right. So when it comes to Radio City, track one, Oh My Soul, is in mono. That's the only mono song on the album. Why was that one in mono and the rest in stereo?
I think they thought it'd be a cool idea. It was kind of a tip of the hat to the way things were. And they probably had the idea, Alex, or because that would have been Radio City, could have been Andy. And, you know, they sort of sussed it out and discovered that, oh, well, wait a minute, this sounds really good mono. I mean, you know, there's an argument for all the Beatles stuff in mono. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it hit us first. And you know how it hit people and how they responded. So it's, you know, there wasn't anything wrong with it. So, right. Yeah, I don't remember the reasoning behind it and stuff other than, gee, that'd be a cool thing to do, I think.
Was Chris still working on some of the songs that ended up on Radio City?
Well, you know, legend has it that Oh My Soul is one of them. There was a light which Chris got and Alex got Oh My Soul or sitting in the back of a car. You know, Alex, Andy, and I had got that in part, I think, because Alex said Andy contributed to a lot of the lyrics for sitting in the back of a car, which, you know, that kind of makes sense, too. Those are three. I think there's one other that Chris got, but I can't think of it.
Okay, all right. In the Big Star documentary, it talked about the Ardent team finding Chris in the studio late at night, destroying some of the multi-track tapes. What was it that he had destroyed, and was it something that was irreplaceable?
We'll be back after these messages.
There's no doubt about it. Record collecting has become a serious hobby and even an investment for many around the world. So record collectors have to ask themselves how best to protect their prized records and confidently buy and sell with others. There is an option to consider. Vintage media grading at vmgvinyl.com. vmgvinyl.com will professionally grade your record and encase it in protective plastic, so your record will retain its value for decades to come. This is the same approach that comic book and sports card collectors have done for years. Now, I know many record collectors will be horrified with the thought of having their records graded and encased in plastic. And for the majority of records, this isn't necessary. But if you have top dollar records that you need to protect, maybe a super rare album that's languishing on the shelf, a one-off misprint, or a special LP that you want to protect, look up vmgvinyl.com, Vintage Media Grading, and see if this service is right for you. That's Vintage Media Grading, vmgvinyl.com.
Hey everyone, I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this ugly split and is even falling completely apart? Well, that's okay, grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips, you can fix that right up. Seems Easy record repair strips repair seam splits from the inside, so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can now slide in and out like new. Turn a $5 record into a $25 functioning collectible. Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to seamseasy.com. That's Seems Easy with two Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE. 10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. In the Big Star documentary, it talked about the Ardent team finding Chris in the studio late at night, destroying some of the multi-track tapes. What was it that he had destroyed, and was it something that was irreplaceable?
It was number one record multi-tracks. He bulk erased them. And so we can't go back and remix those. We can't go back and, you know, solo any of the instrumentation. Or just hear what got recorded, but maybe not used in terms of overdubs and that sort of thing. So you can't, you know, there's no real forensic way of figuring out those, like there is Radio City and Third, of course.
Okay. So every song from number one record, the multi-track, was wiped.
Yeah. I think India Song survived. I think there is a multi-track of India Song, but I'm not sure, which is pretty cool. Andy Song. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's funny because we did some more recording, and I think Andy had this great dry sense of humor. On the tape box, he wrote, conveniently grouped for bulk erasure.
Oh, yeah, I guess you got to have that gallows humor in that situation.
I'm still scratching my head about John. You know, was pretty meticulous about things, and I'm surprised there wasn't a safety 24 track, a 2-inch. Oh, actually, it was 16.
I guess no one was expecting someone to willfully go in there and, you know, probably wipe them.
Yeah, apparently Chris was pretty, could be volatile.
Yeah. Was there anything that particularly sparked that? Was there an argument or a confusion over who wrote what? Was that what initiated that action?
I think, you know, recording, writing, creating music is an emotional thing. You leave yourself vulnerable big time. And who knows, there could have been other things going on as well. And then, you know, Chris left the band more out of writers paid more attention to Alex because Alex had been in the Box Tops, and it made sense. You don't know who Big Star is, but you know this guy, Alex Chilton. He sang the number one record in the nation in 1967. It's called The Letter. And so I don't know what was going through his head. It just could have been a really emotional time for him. Mm-hmm.
After Chris left the band, Big Star continued on. Chris kind of wandered a bit and continued writing. Before his passing, and I think in 78, was he aware of the building legend of Big Star?
He was, because I was in England for the summer, around March 19th through August in 78. And, you know, I'd pick up an NME or a Melody Maker, and there'd always be something about Big Star, whether it's somebody looking for an album or an interview with Alex, or just seemed to always be something.
Okay. So Chris was aware that this work that he'd done is catching on bubbling under in the underground. Any idea what his reaction was? Did you continue contact through the single of I Am the Cosmos?
Yeah, we did. And we talked about maybe getting back together and going to England that summer while I was in England. And, you know, obviously I got back that August, I got back to Memphis, and things just sort of fell apart.
So there were discussions, because I know Alex was on the I Am the Cosmos single, so that communication was still going. So there was a plan, or at least discussion, about potentially reforming the original four Big Star to do some shows.
Well, I don't know about the original four, and I'm not sure about Alex, but Chris and I talked about it. And I think if Alex wasn't on board or whatever, we would have supplemented him with someone. Oh. Or just created something outside of Big Star.
Were there a lot of Big Star live shows? Were there quite a few tours back in the day, the number one record in Radio City era?
No, Andy, Chris, and Alex and I did this thing that was called the BC Tour. And it was Corinth, Mississippi, and Athens, Alabama. We played a university there, and then one other place, and it was all these, you know, Greek BC sounding names. And, you know, that was fun. We had a good time doing that. We played the City Park in New Orleans. That was good. But then, you know, I think we probably played High Cotton here in Memphis a couple of times with Chris. But then, you know, Chris left the band, and we all kind of drifted apart, but got back together for the Rock Writers convention.
Do you know if there's a recording of that Rock Writers show?
I don't. There is a recording of us at Lafayette's, but we were opening for Archie Bell and the Drills. Hmm. you know, we'd finish the song, maybe one person would clap because it just wasn't our audience.
Right. Okay.
But I think there was a recording. I know John Fry was doing, or at least helping, or part of front of house mixing and, or, you know, sound. And it's apparently Alex set his guitar down in front of his amp and was starting to feed back. And John Fry took, you know, maybe pushed up the controls a little bit to make it louder, and then just sort of padded the console. This is what I heard. And left. So just let that sound going.
The history of Big Star, just it there's so many highs and so many lows. And I'm curious as to your, when you look back at that time, is it with love and affection? Is it with a little confusion as to kind of what, you know, how it all came together? You know, what's your perspective on the legacy of Big Star in that time?
Oh, it's love and affection, that's for sure. I mean, well, Chris and Andy and I, you know, we had a three-piece that Alex joined. And so we were pretty close. Then Alex joined, I got to tell you, there was something about the chemistry of the four of us being together, at least the three of them being together, and I happened to be there. There's something about that chemistry, but we never really would hang out together. I would spend more time around Andy, and later after Chris left the band, Chris and I would play tennis together or something. We would talk about music, but not, you know, not that frequently.
Oh, okay. So you stayed friendly with Chris throughout, even though he left the band, but you were still kind of part of the community and speaking and doing things.
Yeah.
Just not as much
Andy
music.
Too.
Right.
I know Andy. I was in the seventh grade. So not on a daily basis, but he and my brother had a band together when I was in the seventh grade. And that was the introduction to Andy. So I'd known him for a long time and was really comfortable with him. And
does it surprise you how beloved this band is and how widely, you know, how global the appreciation is for that, those records?
Well, if I kind of project my own feeling about those records onto everybody else in the world, I would say no. But I will say this, it's whatever it is, it's cool. Because it allows, you know, Luther and me to travel together and write together and have a platform for that. It's, you know, Big Star has a lot to do with that in more ways than just that platform for my having been in the band. I don't know, Big Star kind of informs the way we do a lot of things, Chris. I mean, Luther and I. So musically there's a big part of us, a big part of me for sure.
Yeah. Well, when I listen to those Pretty Wrongs, I hear some lineage of that. I hear the same, I guess the spirit, certainly of the first and second album. And I'd encourage anyone to look up a Holiday Camp on their streaming services and give it a play. So those Pretty Wrongs, when you and Luther are writing music, how does a song from those Pretty Wrongs come together? Is it an idea from one or the other and bringing the other one into the fold, or is it collaborative? How does that work?
Well, the first two songs that we wrote together, I had lyrics and melody lines. Maybe not the lyrics were complete, but the melody lines were pretty developed. But, you know, Luther is pretty brilliant with making little very melodious, to borrow a word from Alex, additions to melody lines and stuff. So, and, you know, Luther completed those musically and just kind of made them shine in that regard. But that happens all different kinds of ways. Luther can send me, like, New September song on Holiday Camp, sent me, hey, I've got this music and this September song. And I'm not sure whether he was actually calling it that as a title, or whether he's just saying, hey, here's a new song and it's in, you know, it's September. So as a way of identifying it. So I just set about writing these lyrics, you know, and you pay attention to kind of what's around you. And there's this beautiful, really big park in Memphis called Shelby Farms. And I was around there and it just kind of inspired the frogs of a summer night sing. And bonfires illuminate the trees, layered ribbons of a cool, cool breeze, announcing fall's awakening. And God knows how I came up with that. I get chills. I mean, it is thrilling to somehow be a little portal of how this stuff gets expressed. But, you know, then there's Luther, who comes up with, you know, killer lyrics and melody lines, or he'll come up with lyrics and I'll put a melody line to it. And like, you know, something inside that picture frame stares at me without a name, familiar yet, but not the same. You know, Luther, those are Luther lyrics. I think he sent them to me and I could be wrong. Maybe I came up with a melody line.
Yeah.
But, and then, you know, we kind of finish the lyrics together, but it's the way you hear that music is such a large part of Luther, and the way he plays guitar and the melodies, via guitar and the other things, and certainly Holiday Camp, it's the backing vocals on, September Song. And so many of those are brilliant. And, you know, aside from Pat Sansone having done a brilliant job on Moog and For Always the Rainbow, and he did Mellotron on Scream, and Chris Damey did strings for Brother My Brother, and Mitch Easter did Glockenspiel.
Oh, Chris Damey's still around, involved.
Yes. He did strings for our second record, too. And he just did a brilliant job with Brother, My Brother. Mm-hmm. So a song about my younger brother, David. And then we had Mitch Easter. So, yeah, it's cool. I mean, and again, Big Star was a common denominator in all that getting together. And, of course, Chris Damey came up with doing Big Star's Third Live and putting that lineup together. And yeah, it's this amazingly supportive community.
Yeah, that's the word I was thinking of. I love the fact that community continues. You continue to work together, even in the same recording studio all these years later, and it's like this continuation of the story. It started with Big Star, but it really is about people and everyone, the community, the musical community of Memphis, and it's really wonderful to watch from afar.
Oh, thanks. It's wonderful, to do. It's amazing to be a part of.
Speaking of watching them from afar here in Australia, we're looking forward to the shows. I want to make sure people are aware. Those Pretty Wrongs, Australia, August 2023. Tickets are at lovepolice.com.au. There's several shows up and down the East Coast. You've got a pretty strong history with Australia, you and the Those Pretty Wrongs and some of the other musical projects, yeah?
Yeah, well, we did Big Star's Third Live there. And flew down for that. That was pretty amazing. And then Luther and I played the Americana Festival here in the States, in Nashville. And a friend of mine, Mary Mihalakos, who lives in Melbourne, brought BT to see us. BT is, you know, Love Police touring. And unbeknownst to us, and Luther and I, it's at the basement in Nashville, and Luther and I were singing, and there was this guy sitting up against a wall and just having the best time of his life. And it made performing that much more fun. And he introduced himself afterwards and wound up inviting us to open for Tweety when they toured Australia. So we went down and did... I think we did five total dates, maybe only two with Tweety and three on our own, or maybe three with Tweety and two on our own. And then we, well, you know, somewhere along the way, COVID hit. But we kind of managed to work it out again with BET bringing us over.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing you. There's 6 dates available. I'll put links in this episode page. Victoria, New South Wales, getting up to Queensland as well. So, Jody, thank you so much for coming on The Vinyl Guide today and tolerating our record nerd questions. Again, as collectors, we love to know all these little facts and stuff, and recognizing that, you know, there are varying degrees of awareness and sometimes even interest in some of the test pressings or some of those sort of things. But I really appreciate you shedding some light and giving us some new facts to work with in our record collecting journey. I want to make sure people know, especially those in Australia, those Pretty Wrongs are coming down here August 2023. There's half a dozen shows up and down the East Coast. Tickets are at lovepolice.com.au. And no matter where you're at in the world, check out the album Holiday Camp. It's brand new. It's on all streaming services. You can enjoy it right now. And if you decide to take the leap and get a copy on vinyl, a physical form, you can go to thosepretywrongs.com and they will steer you in the right direction. Jody, thank you so much for coming on the show, mate.
Thanks for having me. It was a joy. Great questions.
There we go, Mr. Jody Stevens, big star, Those Pretty Wrongs. Looking forward to those shows here on the East Coast of Australia, lovepolice.com.au. Grab some tickets before they sell out because it looks like they're going fast. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Share them out on Facebook. Put them into Facebook groups. Of course, you can always put them out on that Threads app. That seems to be gaining some traction. Of course, you can always tweet it out on Twitter as well. Make mention of it on a Reddit forum, or even just do the analog way. Show your friends how to get the Vinyl Guide podcast on that smartphone of theirs. They'll love you for it, and so will I. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.